Hello everyone, this is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome you to our Diabetes Fundamentals Class 4. In this class, we're going to be talking about medications for type 2 diabetes. And this class is kind of a fundamentals class where we discuss what the medications are, what are their side effects, what are their considerations. So it's really part one of a two-part series. The second part of this program talks about management. Meds management for type 2, and that's part 2. So in this course, the goal is just to kind of share with you the basics of the medications, what they do, their physiology, their pharmacokinetics, and considerations. And also we will do some case studies to determine what medications match which person. So there's a lot of content. When I first started teaching this program 20 years ago, we had one medication class, sulfonylureas, and now there's been an explosion. And so it's a lot of content, but really important content because our patients are coming into us and they're asking us questions about these medications. So as diabetes educators, we may not have prescriptive authority, but we certainly are consultants. We're consultants to providers. They may ask us for suggestions, or we may know that it's some medication strategies aren't working that well for patients, so we may volunteer suggestions. And also we're advocates, you know, for our patients. So we're going to help our patients look at the different medications that are available and kind of determine based on their risk profile, ease of use, and a lot of other factors, which medication matches which patient. So let's take a look at my objectives here. We're going to look at the main action of the different categories of type 2 diabetes meds. We're going to discuss some strategies to determine which medication fits which patient, and we're also going to look at those side effects. Before I get started, what I'd like to do is just launch a poll and say, when you're thinking about choosing medications for patients, which factors are most important to consider when choosing which meds to start patients on? And you can choose more than one. Which factors seem most important? Thanks for voting, everyone. I really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this, and we are actually in consensus. I'm going to share this poll with you, and that is 100% of you said we need to consider all of these factors, their insurance coverage, their ability to self-manage, their willingness to take medication, and their blood glucose history. And you're absolutely right. When we're looking at which medications match which patients, we certainly are going to think about all these different factors. And as we roll through this webcast and online course, we're going to be discussing these different factors and how they apply to our patients. So thanks for voting. I'm going to go ahead and close this and make sure everybody can see my slide, that it's up and running. Okay, we're looking good. So here's some considerations for diabetes agents. And the first one is diabetes medications can be used by themselves or in combination with each other or with insulin. So for patients with type 2 diabetes, we can mix and match to get to the right place. We don't have a lot of great science yet to say what is the right stepwise approach to adding medications on. So there's still some trial and error. As we get more data, hopefully we'll have an algorithm that's a little more set in stone to help us as we move forward. But I'll share what we do have so far. Combining agents from a different class has additive effects. So if we use a sulfonylurea plus a biguanide metformin, those two different classes bring two unique actions and they can work together synergistically to get a better result oftentimes than one med alone. Most reduce A1C 0.5 to 2%. Well, we know that 1% A1C equals 30 points of blood sugar. So at its best, it can drop blood sugars by 60 points, which is really amazing. Currently, these oral medications are off-label use for pregnancy, preconception, or when breastfeeding. But many clinics are using oral medications to treat diabetes during pregnancy and also before pregnancy and afterward. So These rules right now are not in concrete. Many organizations use oral medications. They're off-label, but they seem to be safe. So that's kind of where we're at right now with those. All right. And so patient-centered approach. This is a wonderful slide, and I put this article in your reference library for this course, and it's the ADA and EASD position statement. It was published in 2012, but it's still very relevant today. And this was the first time that these organizations came out and said the following: we should really consider a patient-centered approach, and that is providing care that is respectful of and responsive to individual patient preferences, needs, and values, ensuring that patient values guide all clinical decision. Patient values. That's amazing. I love this. So what they're saying is, if we just tell patients, oh, take this or take this, and we don't engage them in the conversation, they're less likely to take those medications on an ongoing basis because they haven't bought into it. They're not part of the decision-making process. So we definitely want to gauge a patient's preferred level of involvement. What are their resources? What are they able to do? What's realistic for them? And explore with them where possible therapeutic choices. What does that mean? Well, we could say, John, you know, I really think this medication or this medication might be some good choices for you. Let's take a look at the benefits of these together and some of the side effects. Share decision making. Truly, diabetes is a self-managed condition, and those day-to-day choices ultimately lie with the patient. So if we recognize that and we say, we know you make these decisions and we want to help come to a decision together that you can succeed at. This is new from the ADA Standards of Care, and I think it's a really excellent graph. So if you haven't had a chance to take a look at the standards, it's really worth the read, and particularly for this lecture, the section on medications. Really well done. So what it says here is approach to the management of hyperglycemia. For our patients who we want to get that A1C less than 7%, we're going to have to take more action to achieve that goal. For some patients, the A1C, we might let it go above 7. The American Diabetes Association says for some patients, less than 8% may be the target. So for our elderly patients, more frail, lower life expectancy, they aren't very able to participate in diabetes self-management, we may not want to set the goal of A1C of 7. It may not be achievable. And so how do we determine where to set this A1C goal? Well, we look at the risk of hypoglycemia or other adverse drug effects. So to get the A1C down, many times you have to add multiple medications or insulin, and some patients may not be able to tolerate or afford that, or they may have some other barriers. But if their risk is low and they have good, very minimal disease duration or newly diagnosed. So for newly diagnosed patients, we tend to be more aggressive because we know that the first few years of diabetes are most important in getting blood sugars to target, because if early in the disease process we get blood sugars to target, we can protect those beta cells that are remaining. So early in diagnosis, we can help have better outcomes in the long run, also known as a legacy effect. But what if they've had diabetes for 20, 30, 40 years? We may not want to pile on as many medications and get that A1C less than 7 because we know it might put them at risk for hypoglycemia and other problems associated with polypharmacy. Life expectancy, other comorbidities, vascular complication. This is a big one we learned from the ACCORD trial. Is that if they already have cardiovascular disease, pushing their A1C down very low doesn't seem to be very beneficial and can result in hypoglycemia and increased problems. So we're cautious with a lot of vascular disease. And then, of course, patient attitude and resources. So this helps guide us when we meet with the patient, when we're assessing them, where should we set that A1C target? What's realistic for them? What do we want to work toward as a team? So anti-hyperglycemic therapy. What is the first step to get blood sugars down with type 2? It doesn't say medications. What it does say is lifestyle changes. Wow. Okay, this is amazing. So what lifestyle changes? You all know this. Weight control, so losing 5 to 7% of that body weight early on protects beta cells. Healthy eating, making sure our patients see a dietitian, so important. Getting them in diabetes self-management education programs. I just want to mention something about seeing a dietitian. For type 1s who see a dietitian, it effectively lowers their A1C 1%. And type 2s, when they see a dietitian, studies have shown it can drop their A1C 2%. So dietitians are very effective therapeutic intervention that are underutilized. So let's make sure we activate that resource and give our patients the opportunity to meet with those experts. Activity, you know this, 150 minutes a week of activity, and also engaging in some weight-bearing activity. When you do weight-bearing action, you build muscle mass. Muscle chews up sugar. So we definitely want to encourage both, aerobic activity and also using some weights or weight-bearing activities. So let's just take a look at the different classes of medications that are out there. As I mentioned, when I started in the field, all we had was the squirters, the sulfonylureas, and the meglitinides. And now we've added six additional classes of medications. And so how does anyone keep up with all of this? It's really challenging. But we're going to go over these medications today, and then we're going to give you an overview right now with this slide. And then we're going to drill down into each of the individual medications. So if you've had a chance to print out your pocket cards, now's the time to pull those out as we go through these different classes of medications. So I'm going to give an overview right now, and then we're going to drill down and talk about each of these individual medications. And so the first class of medications are the suppressor, known as the biguanide metformin. So I'm going to go to my slide here, and what I've done is just made a copy of my pocket card. So you can see the biguanide metformin decreases hepatic glucose output, so it really does help lower glucose release from the liver. And it does lower A1C very effectively, 1 to 2 percentage point. Let's go to our next one, the sulfonylurea. So those are what I call the squirters. What do I mean by the squirters? Well, they're telling the pancreas to squirt insulin. And they've been around for a while. Here's some examples of those squirters. And you can see they lower A1C 1 to 2 percentage point. We'll detail these out more in a minute. So that's the glycogen stoppers and the biguanides. And these are the squirters. And now we're getting to the satiators. So the satiators include the DPP-4 inhibitors. These are medications that actually increase the availability of gut hormones. So they're going to help increase the level of GLP-1. And you can see they lower A1C by about 1 percentage point. So not as much as the first two, but still very effective. Our SGLT2 inhibitors we call glucuretics. So glucuretics are kind of medication that actually tell the kidneys to release extra sugar. And when you release extra sugar from the kidneys, you not only lower blood sugar, but you can also lose some weight. And you can see that they not only lower A1C, but also body weight. Our thiazolidinediones, I call them my sensitizers, because they actually sensitize the muscles to use glucose more effectively. And they've had some troubles. We'll talk about those later, but they include Actos and Avandia, and they lower A1C up to about 1 percentage point. Now we have the slowers, what I call the slowers, known as precos. Now precos does slow the absorption of carbohydrates in the intestine, so you still get the carbohydrates, you just get it later on in the intestine. One of the major side effects is gas and lots of it, so that's been a problem for this medication. We have the circadian switchers, the dopamine receptor agonists, which actually increase dopamine levels, which lowers blood sugar. They're not used that much, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on those. And last but not least, we have the meglitinides. They're also squirters. They tell the pancreas to make insulin with food, Prandin and Starlex. And they have not been utilized that much, unfortunately, because I think they really offer flexibility. We'll talk about that more in the upcoming slides. The other group of medications in the satiator category are these, the GLP-1 agonist. We have four different versions of this. These are, when you say agonist, or incretin mimetic, they support our gut hormones. And so they're giving a synthetic version of gut hormones to replace what our body doesn't make. And these have been very effective not only at lowering blood sugars, but also at helping people lose weight. And then we have the amylin mimetic. When you have diabetes, you don't make enough amylin. Your pancreas makes that. So they created a synthetic version of it called Semlin. And this actually helps to slow gastric emptying and lower blood sugars. Again, not used very frequently, so we won't spend too much time on it. So that's an overview of all the medications out there to treat type 2. Let's take a minute to drill down on those medications. But before we do, I want to ask you another question. What do you think are some qualities of an ideal diabetes medication? And again, you can choose more than one answer. What are some qualities of the, if you were to make the best diabetes medication out there, what qualities would you include in that medication? Okay. Thank you everybody for voting. 100% of you have voted, so I'm going to go ahead and close and share. And so what we see is that 75% of you chose no weight gain or some weight loss. Absolutely. You know, diabetes, 90% of people are overweight or obese. So gaining weight is really not something they look forward to. No one does, really. So, but if you have diabetes, we want to help patients lose weight or stay the same. That would be really great quality of a drug. Affordable, 100% of you chose that. Absolutely. Only cause hypoglycemia once a week. So this, we would really want to say only causes, you know, never causes hypoglycemia actually would be the best answer. So it is better only once a week than once a day, but really an ideal diabetes medication, we would not have to worry about hypoglycemia. And then D, nobody chose this, slight increase in LDL, that's a bad cholesterol, but 75% of you chose E. Lower cardiovascular risk. Yes, diabetes is considered a cardiovascular disease. So if we can lessen the risk of heart disease, what a benefit. And so these are just some of the qualities we're really looking for now in diabetes medication. And I've listed them here for you. So thanks everyone for voting. No hypoglycemia, no weight gain. Maybe we can lose some weight in addition. You can afford it. It lowers cardiovascular risk. And it's tolerable. Most people can use it and they don't have problems with it. So let's go ahead and take a look at our medications. And now what we're going to do is rate them against our perfect list to see, do they come up short or do they really qualify to get the best rating according to our evaluation? So the first one we've already talked about. So we've talked about all of these medications. Now I'm going to drill down and talk about them in more detail. Is a biguanide known as metformin. And when I say it's a suppressor, it really does suppress the release of glycogen from the liver. This is really important because a lot of our patients with type 2 diabetes will wake up in the morning with high morning blood sugars, and that's the liver. The liver at night releases its glycogen stores because there's not enough insulin to suppress it. And so many times patients wake up with fasting hyperglycemia. It's the liver's fault. And metformin is particularly good at blocking glycogen so that the liver doesn't release its stores and increase morning blood sugars. Also, we'll see that it enhances GLP. So there's some new studies out that shows that metformin actually might help to increase the GLP or gut hormones, the glucagon-like peptide hormones that are released from our intestines when we eat that help lower our blood sugars. So maybe in addition to stopping the release of glycogen, it also might help to enhance GLP production, which would be really terrific. Okay, so who is metformin indicated for? Well, it's indicated for anyone with fasting hyperglycemia. It's really great for people with dysmetabolic syndrome, so those who have hyperglycemia, hyperlipidemia, and hypertension, because not only does it lower blood sugar, it also lowers LDL cholesterol. It's the only pill approved for pediatrics starting at the age 10 and extended release at the age of 17. And so as I mentioned, metformin, its main action, decrease hepatic glucose output. It doesn't cause any liver damage. Some patients say to me, well, I've heard metformin, you know, ruins your liver, it damages your liver. No, it does not at all. There's some mythology out there around that. You do have to have a good working liver to take metformin, but it won't cause any liver problems. The other thing I want to mention is you want to start at a low dose, 500 milligrams, once or twice a day. And for most patients, I recommend starting on extended release. Extended release metformin is a once a day formulation. You can just take it at dinner. And the benefit of this, it causes a lot less GI side effects. So people are able to tolerate it a lot better. And it is a bigger pill. I want to warn you about that. Some people might even call it a horse pill. That you just take it once a day at dinner and it works for 24 hours and a lot less nausea, diarrhea, and problems. Look at how effective metformin is. It's going to lower the A1C 1 to 2 percentage points. Terrific. So what are some of the benefits of metformin? Well, it decreases LDL cholesterol and triglycerides. No weight gain. Many people lose some weight on it. There's some studies that showed it was cancer protective. People with diabetes are more likely to get liver, pancreas, and breast cancer. And it seemed that metformin actually mitigated this risk a little bit. And so it certainly won't harm them. You know, I think that metformin right now is the darling of the diabetes medication world. It's been around for many years, over 40, in Europe and in America, you know, around 20 years. And it has a really good history of safety. The concerns are diarrhea and abdominal discomfort. Use extended release. Lactic acidosis is still a consideration, and there were some studies that showed patients on metformin for more than a year had some B12 deficiency. And so we don't generally test for B12 deficiency. What we say is if you've been on metformin for a year and you're having some neuropathic pain, B12 deficiency is manifested as neuropathy, then let's take some B12 replacement medication or replacement therapy. It's a vitamin, so it's just B12 replacement for that. We want to hold prior to IV contrast dye studies and use caution during acute illness. Now, the reason is metformin is cleared by the kidneys. So we want to make sure that the kidneys are working well to clear the metformin. If the kidneys aren't working well, the metformin may have an extended half-life and can lead to lactic acidosis. There's been very few reported cases of lactic acidosis, but it is our one precaution. And so some contraindications due to risk of lactic acidosis is the creatinine elevated, liver disease, alcohol abuse, over 80 years of age, acidosis risk, IV dye study if they're sick, and CHF requiring medications. But I do want to say with the new ADA guidelines, they suggest that GFR may be a more appropriate measure of kidney function and whether or not metformin is safe. As a matter of fact, in England and European countries, they do use GFR as their cutoff. So what we say, if GFR is less than 45, max dose 1,000 milligrams a day, and if it's less than 30, stop the metformin. And so what I would say, since that's not part of the FDA ruling, in my practice, I'll definitely look at the creatinine. But to really see, to make a more informed decision about risk, I'll look at the GFR too. Because sometimes providers will keep patients on metformin even if their creatinine is greater than these levels, if they kind of see the GFR is stable and holding. And so that's just part of our whole consideration of this medication and its safety. So what I'd like to do now is rate metformin, and then we're going to give it a rating of 1 to 5 stars, saying 5 is, yeah, it's a great medication, 1, not so good. So let's see. Does metformin cause hypoglycemia? No, it actually does not. Metformin does not cause low blood sugar. Does it cause weight gain? No, it doesn't. Is it affordable? Yes, it is wildly affordable. We'll talk about that more later, but you can get a 3-month supply of metformin for $10. Cash pay. Is it lower cardiovascular risk? Yes, it does, because it lowers LDL cholesterol. And can most people tolerate? Yeah, most people can tolerate metformin XR. Some people have trouble with diarrhea and, you know, stomach upset with the regular metformin, so always going toward the XR. So out of 5 stars, what are you all thinking this medication gets? Exactly, 5 stars. That's what I give it to. And so let's just talk about the ADA stepwise approach to hyperglycemia in 2015, and I'll talk about this more in the part 2 series, but the new guidelines say start with lifestyle coaching. And when lifestyle coaching alone, That's, exercise, diet, eating healthily. They don't achieve A1C. Metformin should be added at or soon after diagnosis. So if we just can't achieve that A1C target pretty close to diagnosis, let's add metformin. It has a long-standing evidence base for efficacy and safety. It's cheap and may reduce cardiovascular heart risk. If A1C is not achieved after 3 months, consider adding one of the six treatment options we'll talk about now, or basal insulin. So metformin is kind of our go-to guy if it's not contraindicated, and if we can't achieve our target within 3 months, add a second agent. But it also says if the A1C is 9% or greater, we might, at diagnosis, consider initiating dual therapy or insulin. So we may say, let's do metformin and a basal insulin, or let's do metformin and a secondary med, which we're going to be going over in a minute. This is the ADA standards of care. They've updated this chart. It's another algorithm. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. We'll talk about this in the part two, but I just wanted to show you a few key features. Healthy eating, weight control, increased physical activity, and diabetes education is where we start, and that includes, of course, a dietitian. Then we do metformin. And then over here, they have these different criteria: efficacy, hypoglycemia risk, weight, side effects, cost. This is a really great criteria list to keep in mind. So metformin has high efficacy, low risk of hypo, weight neutral, no weight gain and some weight loss. Side effects we're going to be thinking about is looking at the GFR and the creatinine to prevent lactic acidosis and look at GI side effects. Costs low. So you can see that's why metformin is such a standout. But after 3 months, if we're not achieving our target, we're going to have to add another medication. So these are all the other different classes that are available to us. And you can take a look at this and see where they fall as far as efficacy, hypo, weight, side effects, and cost. And then if we don't achieve control with triple therapy, what the ADA says is keep the metformin, but let's go to basal insulin plus mealtime, or consider a GLP-1, which we'll talk about in a minute, a glucagon-like peptide agonist. The ACE has different guidelines. So the ADA is American Diabetes Association. The ACE is the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology. And they offer us a different perspective. They say, let's look at the starting A1C level. If it's less than 7.5, start monotherapy. And then they've listed the medications in order of desirability. What's the best one? Metformin, number one. They say start here. Metformin is, the lead medication if tolerated. But they say if the A1C is more than 7.5, start metformin plus a secondary agent, another agent. And again, they've listed it in order of desirability. Then they say if the A1C is greater than 9, what are we going to do? Well, no symptoms, start double therapy or triple therapy. But if they have symptoms, start insulin plus other agents. And for each of these, if we're not at goal at 3 months, they move on to the next ladder. So I think these are two different perspectives on how to adjust medications. You could take a look at both. I've put them in your resource list, and it can be, very instructive. And as I've said in our part two of the medications class, we'll go over these in a lot more detail and do some case studies too. Let's take a look at a life study. We have a 59-year-old overweight woman with type 2 diabetes for the past 3 years. She has been trying to control her diabetes with diet and exercise. Her most recent A1C is 8.4%. What medication would you recommend for her? What first medication would you recommend for her? And I'm going to go ahead and launch a poll and see what you all think. Thanks for voting, everyone. I really appreciate it. We'll take a few more seconds. Yeah, so a lot of these, classes of medications, we're learning about, we're not maybe as familiar with some as some of the old school ones. So the purpose of this program is to really kind of share with you the newest medications that are out there and how we use them, and also take a look at our old standbys too. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with you. So 33% of you chose sulfonylureas, and 67% of you chose metformin. And I would just like to say that while sulfonylureas are certainly are effective, they're going to lower A1C to 1 to 2 percentage points, you can see this woman is already overweight. So if we start a sulfonylurea, that can actually enhance weight gain. And the other thing with sulfonylureas is they can cause low blood sugar. So the number one medication for her, which will really help not only with her A1C, it can lower it up to 2 percentage points, but it might even help with her weight a little bit, is a metformin. So metformin, for in my perspective and from the American Diabetes Association and ACE, is a go-to medication that we should start. So this is definitely, metformin would be the medication I'd consider. And then I have a question here, what labs would we look at? We would look at her GFR and her creatinine to make sure it's indicated for her. And if it is safe, that's the medication we're going to go for, the metformin. Thanks, everyone. Let's go on to our next slide, which are sulfonylureas. So sulfonylureas have been around for a long time, since the 40s, and they are really effective. I have here, they tell the pancreas to squirt insulin all day long. So they're going to stimulate the pancreas to release insulin throughout the day. Why is this important? Well, let's suppose I take my glyburide before breakfast, and I eat my breakfast, but I'm late for lunch. Well, that sulfonylurea is still telling my pancreas to squirt out insulin. So if I'm late for lunch, I have a very high potential to get low blood sugar because my pancreas is just keeps squirting insulin. And so that's the main drawback of these medications, since the pancreas is squirting a lot of, since it's telling the pancreas to keep releasing insulin regardless of meals. The potential for hypoglycemia is there, but also the potential for weight gain. On average, these patients gain about five pounds when starting on sulfonylureas. But look how effective they are. They lower A1C 1 to 2 percentage point, but they are definitely inexpensive. They've been around a long time, and they're generic. I also want to point out, many patients don't get any response to these with initial therapy. 5 to 10% don't really respond to them. And with all diabetes medications, after using them for more than 5 years or so, they seem to lose their efficacy. And what that tells us, not to stop that particular medication, but go ahead and add on another. And so usually we'd start with, you know, metformin, and after a few years we might notice if we're at max dose, so always go to max dose, it's not really working as well, then we add on a secondary agent to help support getting them blood sugars to target. Sulfonylureas, these are the second generation sulfonylureas. So they are the newer ones, and they all last for about 24 hours. There's been a lot of controversy around which sulfonylurea to use, but generally speaking, glyburide is the least favorite. It's the most likely to cause hypoglycemia, so it generally is the last choice. Glipizide is kind of one of the favored ones, especially the regular glipizide. It lasts for about 12 hours. There is a glipizide or glucotrol extended release, which works for 24 hours, which is convenient. But if your patients have any issues with kidney problems or their creatinine is slightly elevated, I'm very cautious with these medications. These medications are cleared by the kidneys, so if the creatinine is elevated, these medications may last a lot longer in the bloodstream and lead to hypoglycemia. We also have Amaryl. It's an extended release version, also called glimepiride, lasts for 24 hours. And so sulfonylureas, low blood sugar, weight gain, major drawbacks, cleared by kidneys, so use caution for those with kidney problems, really cheap. And there is a problem too with cardiac remodeling. So if anybody has heart disease, Amaryl is the safest choice of the sulfonylureas. So let's go ahead and talk about the meglitinides, and we'll rate these medications. So the meglitinides are fast-acting insulin secretagogues, and what they do is they get in and tell the pancreas to squirt out insulin with meals. So they're really great at targeting postprandial hyperglycemia. The meglitinides are not used that much. I'm going to come back to that slide. They're prandin and Starlix. Now, prandin is interesting because it's metabolized by the liver and excreted in the feces. So if you have patients with kidney problems on dialysis, prandin is a really good go-to medication because they would just take it with each meal, and it doesn't cause as much risk of hypoglycemia for patients with any kidney problems. But that's one of the main drawbacks with an agglutinizer. You have to take it with every meal. You have to remember to take it. But it does cause less hypoglycemia and less weight gain than the sulfonylureas. However, the insurance companies have not been as likely to cover it, so it's not being prescribed as much. So before we go back to that slide I skipped, I want to ask you one other question, and that is, which of the following meds for type 2 diabetes are cheapest? Which of the following meds are cheapest? And you can choose more than one answer. Okay, thanks for voting, everyone. I really appreciate it. So 50% of you chose glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride, which are the sulfonylureas. 100% of you chose metformin, and 25% of you chose Januvia and Onglyza. Well, B and C are the correct answers. I'll just go ahead and share this really quick, and then I'll hide it. So you could see how the distribution was, but B and C are the right answers. Glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride, and metformin are the cheapest. And I want to go back to the slide that I passed and show you. When the goal is to minimize costs, so a lot of our patients may not have insurance, or they may be cash pay, or they may be in a donut hole, you want to go toward the metformin and sulfonylureas. Walmart does offer a 3-month supply for only $10, and that's for the XR version of metformin and for any of the sulfonylureas. So really reasonably priced, work very well. So these are kind of your go-to meds for your patients who are struggling financially or have limited resources. And for a lot of my patients, their copay is bigger than what it would cost them to pay out of pocket for these. So I'm always trying to figure out where they're at, what are their resources, and what's most affordable for them. Other generics do include Actos and Avandia and Acarbose, but they can still cost up to $100 a month. And I've actually dedicated a whole newsletter to this because I had so many patients struggling to pay for their meds. So you can click on that link and you'll be taken to my Meds on a Budget article that I posted a few months back. Okay, so now that we found out which meds are cheapest, what I want to do is rate the squirters. How do they rate? How do the sulfonylureas and magglutinides work? As far as how are we going to critique them? Do they cause hypoglycemia? Yes, they do. Do they cause weight gain? Yeah, they do. The sulfonylureas cause more weight gain and the magglutinides a little bit less, but you'll gain weight on either one. Are they affordable? Yeah, they are. Sulfonylureas are very affordable. The magglutinides are still a little bit more expensive, but for sure the glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride, very affordable. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? No, they don't. Can most people tolerate them? Well, some people can, especially if they have, you know, good renal function. But for a lot of our patients, especially elderly or frail patients, really difficult to tolerate with that risk of hypoglycemia. So what do we rate the squirters out of 5? What would you give them? Well, I'm going to give them a 3. They're very effective and they're totally affordable. They're pretty easy to take, but the side effects of weight gain and hypoglycemia really caused me to consider that if that's the right med for my patient. Well, let's kind of take a look at another case study here. We have a 72-year-old who's thin. She lives alone. Her A1C is 7.3. She has a history of a myocardial infarction and a stroke. Diabetes for 12 years. She says she's diet controlled and she has limited income. Her creatinine, 1.4. I'm going to just launch a poll here. Which would be the best medication or the best action to take with her? And you can choose more than one answer on this one also. Thanks for voting, everyone. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share the results. So 25% of you said to start metformin. So I'm going to talk about these answers each individually because they're so important. So the thing about metformin is it doesn't work that good on thin elderly patients. Metformin actually might promote some weight loss. So if I'm working with any patients who are a little bit on the lean side, underweight, older, I'm really going to be reluctant to start on metformin. It would not be the first medication I go toward. So for her, I'm going to say metformin is not the choice because it might cause her to lose some weight and it might give her some GI distress. And if she's already not eating that much, I don't really want to add to that. And also, it's not very effective on this group of patients. So B, encourage her to lose 5% of her body weight. Nobody chose that right because she's already lean. But start low-dose glipizide. 75% of you chose that, and I think that's a very reasonable answer for two reasons. One, we know that glipizide causes the pancreas to make more insulin, and as a result, she might gain some weight. She's already thin, so she might be able to afford a little bit of weight gain. Now, you might say, well, she lives alone, and she's older. Is this really safe for her? Well, certainly, if she's going to be started on this medication, we need to make sure she has a meter and that she can check her blood sugars and that she can be on this medication safely. She understands the signs of low blood sugar, how to recognize it, and the treatment for it. And so the other thing I like about low-dose glipizide for her, it's cheap. She's on a limited income. So even if she was cash pay, she could probably afford this. So I'm going to say yes, I agree with that. And then 75% of you said continue current strategy and monitor on an ongoing basis. I also agree with that. And that is for a lot of our older patients, frail elderlies, the A1C target, we can give relax out a little bit. You know, they'll say keep the A1C less than 8%. That would be acceptable. She's 7.3. And so maybe we just leave her where she's at and say, let's just keep an eye on it. If it starts going up, we'll consider intervention. But what if she says to you, you know what? I've always had an A1C less than 7. This is driving me crazy. I've got to get my blood sugars down. And this is based on a true story that I worked with. And I had a patient who said to me, I can't take this A1C of 7.3. And so we actually did start a medication, and we started him on the DPP-4 inhibitor known as Januvia. So let's go ahead and talk about that. So we could go either way. So we're going to, again, it's patient-centered, patient-based, listening to this patient and see what her goals are. Maybe she's not that motivated. She just wants to leave it where it's at. She's already on a lot of medications. She doesn't want to add one more to her pile. Maybe we'll leave her where she's at. But definitely make sure to have her see a dietitian because some patients in this situation, I've met them, do this thing called carbohydrate restricting where that they're just not eating any carbs to get their blood sugars down. So we want to find out her relationship with food, especially since she's thin too. So definitely considering a referral to the dietitian would be very important. But let's take a look at what medication we might use besides the glipizide. And here we have the DPP-4 inhibitors. There's four of them. And they're called the incretin enhancers. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that they're going to increase the ability or the level of available gut hormone in our bloodstream. And so they block the enzyme DPP-4 from breaking down our gut hormone. And so what happens then is that when we have more gut hormone, we have a more increased insulin release with meals because our gut hormone tells our pancreas, hey, you're eating, release some insulin. And our gut hormone also suppresses glucagon. So if you have more of it available, when you suppress glucagon, you suppress release of sugar from the liver. So this medication, by enhancing and the availability of gut hormone and inhibiting the enzyme from breaking down our gut hormone, increases insulin release with meals and suppresses glucagon. We have a bunch of them available, Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta, and Nucina. And they're all once-a-day dosing, and they all decrease A1C by about a half a point to up to almost 1 percentage point. So you could see this is not generally a first-line medication, but if a patient is just barely above target, like our 7.3 gal, it is a good choice. Because we just want to get her below 7, it might be the right medication for her. It's only indicated for type 2s. So what are some considerations for Januvia and Onglyza? Well, they're eliminated via the kidneys, so lower dose might be needed. And so these medications will not cause hypoglycemia, but if they're not cleared by the kidneys, the metabolites can build up, so you need less. It doesn't cause weight gain or hypoglycemia, so that's sounding really good to us right now. The major side effects, headache, runny nose, sore throat, and it does have a pancreatitis warning. All medications in this class I'll be talking about right now do have a risk for pancreatitis. They're watching them very closely, and it doesn't seem like this is a serious risk, but we're still on the lookout for it. We'll talk about that more. But look at the cost, $100 to $150 a month if I'm cash pay or I don't have good insurance. So these medications are not cheap, but they have the benefit of no weight gain nor hypoglycemia, easy to take, well tolerated. So let's rate these medications. DPP-4 inhibitors, do they cause hypoglycemia? Nope, they don't. Do they cause weight gain? No, they don't cause any weight gain. Are they affordable? No, they're actually not very affordable. I mean, if you have good insurance, they might cover them 100%, and then they would be affordable for you, but it might, depending on your copay and what your insurance coverage is, this answer will be variable, but from a cash perspective, expensive. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? No, they actually don't. So they don't improve cardiovascular outcomes. And can most people tolerate or use them? Yeah, absolutely. Easy to take, once a day. Most patients don't even notice that they're taking it. So what would you rate this out of 5 stars? Well, I'm going to rate it. Let me go back one. I'm going to rate it a 3. I'm going to rate it a 3 because it doesn't lower A1C as much as some of those other ones do, you know, less than a percentage point. It's expensive. But I do give it good ratings because it doesn't cause low blood sugar or weight gain. So I'm going to give it a 3. And the other reason I'm not as enthusiastic is we don't have a lot of long-term studies on it. For example, metformin, we have so much data collected. These, since they've been released in the last decade, we have a little bit less. So I'm more cautious. So I gave it a 3. Maybe you gave it more. Maybe you gave it less. So you can see our patients bring their perspective. Diabetes educators, we bring our own personal biases too. And so that's also a place where we have to meet somewhere. We both bring our perspective and our relationships to these different medications to the table. So I think that's an interesting point to consider too. Okay, let's take a look at this patient. She's on metformin and sulfonylurea, but her A1C is 8.4%, and the patient is really struggling with her weight. What are we going to do? And I do want to say many of my patients come in with this feeling of complete despair. I've done everything. I'm trying to eat right. I'm taking my medications. I'm checking my blood sugar. And I just can't get my weight down. I'm even exercising. And so they feel very discouraged. So for this gal, she's going to be 44 years old. I'm at metformin and sulfonylurea. She's really struggling with her weight. What medications or what action would you take or would we consider supporting her with? And you can choose more than one answer on this one also. Okay, we'll take a few more seconds to vote. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate your voting because I'm used to, you know, presenting in person. So it's really great for me to see, get your feedback via these polls. I appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. I'll take one more second if anybody else wants to vote. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close. Thank you so much. And let's just share this because I think this is really an important concept here. So she's on metformin and sulfonylureas. And we know sulfonylureas can contribute to weight gain. She's struggling with weight. Her A1C is still not at target. And so 100% of you said to refer to an RD. Absolutely. This is a perfect RD referral. And as you know, Patients with diabetes should really check in with an RD yearly and is covered by insurance. So let's make sure we utilize that important resource. Now, 25% of you said suggest a GLP-1 agonist. I think that's a great idea. We're going to be talking about those right in a few minutes. The GLP-1 agonists like exenatide, liraglutide, not only lower blood sugars, but they help with weight loss in addition. So we'll talk about that more. So B, yes, absolutely. Now, increased dose of sulfonylurea, 25% of you chose that. I would actually say I would avoid that because sulfonylureas already have or cause weight gain. And so if we increase the dose of sulfonylurea, she might even gain further weight. So I would say keep the sulfonylurea where it's at, but continue the metformin. And then D, suggest a SGLT2 inhibitor. What is that? SGLT2 inhibitors, we're going to talk about more, are those glucuretics, and they help patients not only lower blood sugar but lower body weight. So I agree with A, B, and D. Absolutely. No one chose starting insulin, and that's a great, you could start insulin to help her lower her blood sugars, but starting insulin might promote weight gain. And so we'll have that in our back pocket as a strategy to get her blood sugars down, but with her distress around her weight, it would be my last choice. I try other things first before that. Okay, so let's talk about the first thing I mentioned in the poll, the GLP-1 agonist. So let me give you some definitions here. When we use the word incretin mimetic, so mimetic means imitator, and incretin is just a word they made up, the scientists, for gut hormones. So when you say incretin mimetic, it means gut hormone imitators. And then you'll see something else called GLP-1 agonists. What does that mean? GLP-1 agonists are the synthetic versions of gut hormones that patients can inject to help lower their blood sugar. So you might hear them referred to in all three of these ways: incretin mimetics, gut hormone imitators, or GLP-1 agonists. And probably this is the most, the third one is the most common way of seeing, I'm seeing them described in the literature or in, journals. They'll call them GLP-1 agonists. So what I'd like to do now is just take a look at the human body and look at the effects of GLP-1 in humans. And let's just look at what normally is supposed to happen. So when we eat food, we release this hormone called GLP-1 from the L cells of our intestine. Now this GLP-1 actually tells our pancreas and the beta cells to release insulin. So the GLP-1s increase beta cell response. This is important because when we eat food, we want our pancreas to squirt out some insulin. It also tells our alpha cells not to make glucagon. Now, glucagon is a hormone that our pancreas makes that actually increases blood sugars. So we want to suppress that hormone after we eat. The other thing it does is tells our liver, do not release glycogen stores. So when you release less of the glucagon, it tells the liver, don't release glycogen stores. Because truly, glucagon does work on the liver to tell it to release glucose. So if you suppress glucagon, then the liver makes less sugar. It also helps regulate gastric emptying. So what it slows down the absorption or the passage of food to the duodenum. So if you slow down the passage of food, you feel full earlier. You get satiety signal to your brain. And these GLP hormones are very important in telling your brain, hey, I'm full, stop eating, because you're getting that sense of fullness in your stomach. And so GLP-1 hormones are extremely important in helping to regulate not only blood glucose, but body weight, because these hormones help us to not overeat. I want to tell you one other thing about these hormones, is that GLP-1 is degraded by DPP-4 within minutes. So let's just translate that to English. So the gut hormone, GLP-1, is degraded by the enzyme DPP-4 within minutes. That's like, in our body, we have things that switch on and then hormones or enzymes that switch things off. So in our body, when we eat, we release GLP-1, and then an enzyme is released to degrade it within minutes, DPP-4. So let's just talk about diabetes for a minute. When you have diabetes, you make about 50% less GLP-1. So you make less of the gut hormone. Plus in diabetes, the enzyme that breaks down the GLP-1 is hyperactive. The DPP-4 is just overactively breaking down whatever gut hormone we do make. And so how do we fix that? There's two ways to fix it. One is that we can inject a synthetic gut hormone, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. So we can inject this synthetic gut hormone to replace what we're not making, or we could stop this enzyme from breaking down what gut hormone we do make. And that's when we were talking about Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta, and Nucina. They were DPP-4 inhibitors. You see, they inhibit this enzyme so that you have more gut hormone available. I'll say that one more time. So the DPP-4 inhibitors, like Januvia, Onglyza, Nucina, Tradjenta, they actually block the enzyme or inhibit the enzyme DPP-4 from breaking down our gut hormone, so you have more available. Okay, great. So that's a DPP-4 inhibitor, but now let's talk about synthetic versions of GLP or GLP-1 agonists. And our first one is the incretin mimetic or GLP-1 agonist, imitator here called Byetta. And there's also Bydureon extended release. So let's take a look at this. These medications, because they imitate our gut hormones, increase insulin release in response to meals, slow gastric emptying, make us feel full, and there's some new data that maybe they even protect our beta cells. So some studies show that if you initiate these incretin mimetics early on in the course of the disease of type 2 diabetes, beta cells last longer. Wow, that's really important because having any beta cells left really help protect against hyperglycemia, but also hypoglycemia. So this is very interesting. And actually, if you've noticed on the previous slides by AACE and also ADA, they said consider incretin mimetics or GLP-1 agonists in addition to metformin or in addition to insulin to help get blood sugars down. So these really are increasing in status as far as a second-line medication to use because of their beta cell protection and weight loss. Let's just talk about that a little bit more. Exenatide dosing. So the regular exenatide, you take twice a day before breakfast and dinner. But that's rarely being used anymore because now we're going to the long-acting version called Bydureon. And Bydureon, you only have to take it once a week. Once a week. And the pens are now available, which makes it a lot easier to use. Before, you'd have to take the powder and the liquid and shake it up and inject it. But even for the once a week injections, there's now a pen available. But look at this. They decrease the A1C by 7% and body weight by 3 pounds. Type 2s can take it. They can take it in monotherapy or in combination therapy. And here's the once a week Bydureon pen. There is some steps involved because it's still a powder and a liquid, but you just twist the pen to mix the two together and shake it up, and then you can inject it. So it's a lot less work and a faster learning curve for our patients. So it's a 2 milligram dose. It decreases A1C, look at this, by 1.6%. This is a once a week injection. Weight by 6 pounds. Holy mackerel. For type 2s only. And there are precautions with all of these medications that either decrease the DPP-4 enzyme or enhance GLP-1 or imitate GLP-1. We have an indication of pancreatitis warning. And also for these long-acting versions, we have to watch out for medullary thyroid tumor. In the animal studies, the rodents had more medullary thyroid tumor. So anybody with a history of thyroid cancer really should avoid these long-acting versions of medications, of the incretin mimetics. Okay, so Byetta came out. They were the first one to make Bydureon a once-a-week injection, but then many followed after. And we have right here albiglutide or Tandem. It's a once-a-week injector, and you can see just like the Bydureon, there's a powder and then there's liquid, so you have to twist and shake and then inject. but very easy for our patients to use. It's a once a week injection. How great is that? It drops A1C by 1 percentage point, weight maybe about 2 pounds. Weight tends, patients seem to continue to lose some weight even after taking this for a while. It's a pen injector, and again, the pancreatitis and medullary thyroid tumor warning. The third one here, and this is the one I added to your slides in your handouts, is Trulicity dulaglutide. And this again is a once a week injection, lowers A1C by about the same amounts, and it's indicated for type 2 and monotherapy or in combination therapy. But of all the injectors, this seems to be the most patient friendly. It comes in a single dose pen, does not require mixing, measuring, or needle attachment. And the needle is hidden from the user and retracts after use. So really good technology on the injector here. Again, black box warning and also pancreatitis warning. And we also have Victoza. We have a lot in this class now, so patients have a lot to choose from. But Victoza is not a once a week. It's a once a day GLP-1 analog or agonist. And the timing is not critical. You take it once a day. You start at a lower dose, and you gradually increase over a few weeks. And the main side effect of all these medications that patients might complain about are nausea. So do let them know they might feel a little bit nauseated. And actually, the nausea is one of the reasons perhaps that people aren't gaining as much weight on these. So they're willing to tolerate the nausea because of the weight loss that they see. So it lowers A1C by about 1 percentage point. Again, body weight similar, 5 to 6 pounds. And you can use it in monotherapy or in combination therapy, and it comes in a pen with the same warnings. Tumor warning and also the pancreatitis. But I want to let you know that liraglutide was recently approved for weight loss. So this is interesting. The new weight loss medication is called Saxenda. And Saxenda and Victoza have the same active ingredient known as liraglutide, but at different doses. The weight loss version is 3 milligrams. The Victoza is 1.8 milligrams. So Saxenda is a treatment option for chronic weight management in addition to a reduced calorie diet and physical activity. Who is it recognized or approved for? And that is people with a BMI with 30 or greater. This is not diabetes. This is just for people who are overweight, or a BMI of 27 or greater who have hypertension, type 2 diabetes, or dyslipidemia. And from the studies I read, people really do experience some excellent weight loss, 5-10 pound weight loss on this medication that was originally approved for diabetes and now is being used to help with weight management. So interesting. You might have patients ask you about that. But for all the previous GLP-1 agonists, we definitely want to let our patients know about pancreatitis. And please tell all patients to report any signs of pancreatitis right away and stop the medication. Those signs include sudden abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. And so those are what patients should let their provider know right away, and it is reportable to the FDA. But as I mentioned, they're doing some long-term studies on patients on these medications, and they've had very few incidents of pancreatitis associated with these medications. So it's looking very positive. If your patients watch late-night television, they're going to ask you questions about pancreatitis because late-night, they talk about, the lawyers bring up medications and what to watch out for. So they've done a good job of scaring patients, but I've been watching the studies really closely, and it seems to be a very minimal risk. Okay, so incretin mimetics, how do they rate? Do they cause low blood sugar? No, they actually don't. Do they cause weight gain? No, and actually people lose weight on them. Are they affordable? No, they're really expensive. Any new drug is generally pretty darn expensive. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? No, they really haven't been shown to do that. But they do seem to protect beta cells. Can most people tolerate or use these? Well, I say yes, no. I say yes, no for almost all these medications. Most people, can tolerate the nausea and a little bit of, GI upset. But some people may struggle with injections, but the needle is pretty small. So I would say most people can tolerate it, especially if they're motivated to lose weight. And so what do you all give this out of five? I gave it a 4 out of 5. I really would like to give it a 5. I'll tell you why. Because no weight gain, people lose weight, no hypoglycemia. It seems to protect the beta cells. But the main reason I can't give it a full-on 5 is the cost. Still really cost prohibitive. Hopefully in the future, as it maybe will become generic, we can see the costs go down. That would be really terrific. But I feel very positive about this class of medication and hope to see it used more in our work settings. Okay, let's do another situation. We have a 69-year-old male. His BMI is 25. He's on metformin 1,000 milligrams twice a day and exenatide 10 micrograms before breakfast and dinner. His A1C is 8.1 and his creatinine is 1.2. He's overweight and he has 11-year history of diabetes. So let's just take a look at this case study. BMI of 25 is still considered borderline. He's not overweight yet, but he's almost overweight. He's on the max dose of metformin and he's on one of those GLP-1 agonists called exenatide. He takes it twice a day. But his A1C is still elevated. And so what could we do next? What would be our next step? And I'm going to go ahead and launch that for you. Let's see what you think. And yes, you can choose more than one right answer. Thanks everyone for voting. I really appreciate it. We'll take one more second, 2 more seconds. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Oh, good. We got everyone. Okay, great. Thank you. So let me go ahead and share your results. So 60% of you said refer to RD and DSME. Well, I'm going to say yes to that. That's a great idea. Even though he's had diabetes for 11 years, it's hard to manage diabetes. It's a lot of work and people, they kind of get burned out a lot of times. And maybe they have old information about nutrition or medications. They don't know all their options. So always getting them reconnected to a dietitian or see an individual diabetes educator, which is covered by Medicare, is a great idea. Now, 20% of you said start basal insulin. And so here's kind of the rule of thumb. We'll usually try 3 medications before we go to insulin, but insulin would not be wrong. It definitely would be something we consider, but let's see if there's any other tools that we might be able to use to get blood sugars down before insulin. So, that's not a wrong answer, but let's just see if there's any other strategies we could try. 20% of you said consider adding an SGLT2 inhibitor like Invokana. Okay, I'm liking that a lot because Invokana definitely will help with his weight management. He's overweight. Oh, I think he gained some weight during this case study. So I think I actually wanted to give him a BMI of 27. I did. Yes, thank you, in the pop-up box. So, he could help. We could support him in some weight loss. Nobody chose start bolus insulin. Great job. And nobody said stop orals, go to bolus. Generally, we don't stop orals and go to basal bolus. We would keep him on metformin. Why do we keep him on metformin? Because metformin will help decrease insulin resistance. Keep him on metformin, and then if you have to go to insulin, add the insulin on. Very important. But I'm just going to say one more thing. We don't really recommend keeping people on sulfonylureas if they're on insulin. That does not seem to have very good outcomes. So that's just an aside, but we would definitely stop sulfonylureas, but keep them on metformin. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and hide this and see what the next strategy might be. And I'm going to talk about our SGLT2 inhibitors, also known as glucuretics. So if you look at your pocket card, we have 3 in that class. We have canagliflozin, dapagliflozin and empagliflozin. The newest one is Jardiance, and Farxiga was second to be released. I have these posted in order of release, and Invokana was the first one. And so this medication is really cool because it decreases renal absorption in the proximal tubule of the kidneys. I have here, it resets renal threshold and increases glycosuria. What does that mean? So I'll just tell you, normally our renal threshold for glucose is 180, but when you get diabetes, it upregulates to 210. So that means you're pulling back sugar through your kidneys. Even if your blood sugar is 190 or 200, your kidneys don't release it. This medication says, let's help the kidneys let go of the sugar at 180. So it resets the renal threshold down to 180, so you release the sugar. And look how effective it is. It lowers A1C 0.7% to 1.5, and patients lose weight, 1 to 3 pounds. For these various medications, we want to keep an eye on the kidneys. So initially, when you start these medications, it's a glucuretic, so a lot more fluid and sugar is going to be flowing through the kidneys, and it might temporarily depress GFR. You might see the GFR bump down a little bit. So we're going to use GFR as our threshold. And you can see if GFR is less than 45, stop Invokana. If GFR is less than 60, stop Farxiga. And do not start patients with GFR less than 45 on Jardiance. So these are numbers that are good to know for you. If your patients come in and they're on these medications, take a look at your GFR and make sure there's a good match. Also, another consideration is we want to monitor blood pressure, potassium, and renal function. So as you're losing all this fluid and sugar, you're also losing volume. So patients can get orthostatic hypotension, plus they might have a drop in their potassium. So we want to monitor their electrolytes, blood pressure, renal function, and proceed with caution. The other thing that we definitely want to keep in mind is infection. Since you're going to be flushing out all the sugar through the bladder, there's more bladder infections. Plus, as you're urinating it out, there's more sugar in the urine. So we'll see more genital infections also. So I let my patients know about that, not only women getting genital infections, but men also. They need to know that that's an issue. Report that and let your provider know. We will have to treat that. Okay. So, looking at the efficacy from not only a blood sugar perspective, but a weight loss, positive in both arenas. So considerations, I mentioned these, may temporarily lower GFR, monitor potassium, blood pressure, renal function. Here's the side effects. And some other benefits is that it actually might reverse glucose toxicity and help transport more glucose into the muscle. 85% of glucose after we eat is utilized by the muscle. So any opportunity for muscles to chew up more sugar is really good. And it increases liver sensitivity to insulin and decreases gluconeogenesis. So those are some other secondary benefits of these SGLT2 inhibitors. So now you can see that patient who was on exenatide and he was on metformin and blood sugars and A1C were still above target, we could certainly think about adding this SGLT2 inhibitor to really help with not only his blood glucose but also his weight loss. So let's take a look at the SGLT2 inhibitors. Do they cause low blood sugar? No, they don't. They won't cause low blood sugar. Do they cause weight gain? Nope, they don't cause any weight gain. Actually, people lose weight on them. Are they affordable? Absolutely not. If you're a cash pay and your insurance doesn't pay for this, they're expensive. They're brand new. They're just out of the gate. Not very affordable. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? No, no studies to prove that. Can most people tolerate? I have several patients on these meds. They complain about urinating more through the night. That is one big issue for them. And that seems to be more true at first when they start on the medications, and it seems to stabilize over time. So I would say they're pretty tolerable, and people appreciate the weight loss and sometimes even the improvement in blood pressure that they see on these medications. So what would I give this out of 5? What are you all giving it? Well, I'm giving it a 3.5. And the reason I'm giving it a 3.5 is because it's still really new and we haven't really seen its long-term, effects. It's expensive, but I really appreciate the fact that it causes weight loss and maybe even might help blood pressure a little bit. Plus, there's no hypoglycemia. And it's pretty easy to take. So I would say 3.5 to 4, but still 3.5, proceed with caution. I do want to mention there were some studies also giving this to patients with type 1 diabetes. And it's totally off-label, not FDA approved, but it seemed to be pretty beneficial for type 1s also. So we might see more about that in the future. Okay, so let's move on to our next class of medications, the insulin sensitizers. Those are known as Avandia and Actos, and those have been around for 20 years. They've been around for a long time. And they're effective because they actually decrease insulin resistance by making muscle and adipose cells more sensitive to insulin. Interesting. When you have diabetes, your muscle cells resist insulin, but also your fat cells resist insulin. So you're insulin resistant in your fat and your muscle. When you're insulin resistant in your fat cells, your triglycerides go up and you have a lot more free fatty acids floating around. What's the problem with free fatty acids? Well, free fatty acids cause a lot of oxidative stress. And in other words, they cause a lot of inflammation in the blood vessels. So free fatty acids really do contribute to vascular disease. And so if there's any medication that can help reduce free fatty acids and triglycerides and enhance insulin sensitivity, we really appreciate that action. And these medications do those. And they're really effective at those two particular aspects of diabetes. And their names are Actos and Avandia. So Actos was doing really well in that it didn't get the bad press that Avandia did as far as increasing the risk of heart disease. We'll talk about that more. So Actos was doing well until a few years back when a few countries were doing some long-term studies, and it seemed that patients who were on long-term Actos more than a year had an increased risk of bladder cancer. So many countries did stop offering Actos. They made it not available anymore. America is still prescribing Actos, and as a matter of fact, Kaiser is involved in long-term studies looking at, is it really true? Is there increased bladder cancer with patients on Actos, or was it just a finding that really isn't a causal effect? Actos isn't causing it, but it just seemed appeared to be. So we're going to get some more data hopefully in the next few years. But currently, if you have a patient on Actos, warn them about reporting any blood in their urine, or certainly if they have a history of bladder cancer in their own person or in their family, this is not a good choice for them as far as medications. Now, Avandia a few years ago was restricted. But this last year, they've relaxed the restriction. Avandia was restricted because it seemed to increase the risk of death from heart attack. But that, after they did a lot of studies at FDA, they found out that was not true. So now the restriction is relaxed. So both Avandia and Actos have had their trials and tribulations. But a lot of patients, because of that initial scare, are not on Avandia and are not interested in going back on it. And it's really unfortunate because this medication really does offer a special benefit. But let's look at some of the other considerations. It does reduce A1C 0.5 to 1%. So it's not, the big guns like some of our other ones, but we do see a reducing A1C. It takes 6 weeks to reach maximum effect. So once you start it takes 6 weeks to kick in. And once you stop it, it takes 6 weeks to get out. It costs about $100 a month if you're cash pay, so it is generic. It's still a little bit expensive. But here's the main bugaboo, is that it causes fluid retention. So patients on this medication can gain, 5, 10 pounds of fluid. So when I have patients who start on this medication, the first thing I look at when they walk in, of course, after I greet them, is their ankles, because you'll see the fluid retention and swelling in their ankles. So not indicated for anyone with congestive heart failure. Start the dose low and gradually increase. The other thing I want to mention I don't have on the slide, it's a very important point, now I'm going to add it in, is that it does increase risk of fracture of the bones, especially in the wrist and the ankle. And if you look at the new ADA standards of care, people with diabetes already have increased risk of fracture. And so you don't really want to augment that with a medication if we're working with patients who are older and are at risk for falling. So I do want to point that out also. So let's rate this drug. TZDs, actose navandia, how do they rate? Do they cause low blood sugar? No, they actually don't. Do they cause weight gain? Ah, yes, they do. And it's not like fat weight gain, it's fluid weight gain. And so what I tell patients, if you gain more than 5 pounds on this medication, please let your provider know right away. We might have to stop it or, you know, reduce the dose. Is it affordable? Well, it is generic, but it still can cost up to $100 a month if you're cash pay. Does it lower cardiovascular risk? Well, this is kind of an interesting question because it does reduce free fatty acids and triglycerides, and it does seem to help decrease endothelial inflammation. So I'm just going to put a question mark there. We need some more data. Can most people tolerate or use? Yeah, it's easy to take, doesn't cause low blood sugar, but watch for that weight gain, and really not for people with congestive heart failure or at risk. And just by having diabetes, you're at risk for congestive heart failure, so we really proceed with caution. So what do we rate this medication out of 5 stars? What do you give this one? Yeah, I'm with you. I'm around a 2.5 on this medication, especially for the CHF and the weight, the fluid retention issue is a big deal. And then the fractures for our frail elderly patients. Okay, we have a few more meds to cover. I'm going to spend less time on these since they're not used as much. But the glucosidase inhibitor, acarbose, or miglitol. And I have this guy here holding a sign, slow. Because what this medication does is that it slows the absorption of carbohydrate from early in the intestine to later. It's a glucosidase inhibitor, so it's, again, an enzyme inhibitor that slows the breakdown of carbohydrates. It has minimal systemic absorption, so it has a really excellent safety profile, and it does help to target postprandial blood sugars. So it really does help to lower post-meal blood sugars because you don't get that spike up from the carbohydrate intake. You have to start the dose low and gradually increase, and the dose is based on weight. If you start at too high a dose, as I've mentioned, since it causes the carbohydrates to be ingested later in the intestines, the bacteria are very involved in utilizing this carbohydrate. And when bacteria get involved through a process known as fermentation, there's a lot of flatulence. So certainly not for anybody with inflammatory bowel disease or cirrhosis or anybody with, you know, abdominal issues. It drops the A1C 0.5 to 1% and really effective on lowering that post-meal blood sugars. So special consideration, this is important to take note, especially if you're taking the exam. If you have any patient on this medication and they're also on a sulfonylurea or insulin, we can't treat a low blood sugar with sugar. It won't work because the carbohydrate absorption is delayed. The only two things we can treat low blood sugar with are a glucose tab, which is dextrose, or milk. Other starches are blocked by medication, so fruit juice is not going to work. Very important for your patients to know if they are on this medication and they get low blood sugar. So how would we rate acarbose? Does it cause low blood sugar? No, it doesn't. Weight gain? Nope. Affordable? Yeah, it's pretty affordable. Does it lower heart risk? There are some studies that showed, yes, it does lower cardiovascular risk. And can most people tolerate? Well, it never really took off because a lot of people had trouble tolerating the flatulence. But if you get past that, it is very tolerable and it's safe and it's not systemically absorbed. So I'm going to give this a 2 out of 5 just because most people aren't using it. Let's wrap up with our last class of medication, and that is the amylin mimetic pramlintide. So when I say amylin mimetic, your pancreas normally makes a hormone called amylin, but when you have diabetes, type 1, you make none, and type 2s, they make less than 50% of normal. Amylin is a very important hormone because it prevents post-meal rise in glucagon, it slows gastric emptying, and it increases satiety. So what they did in 2005 is they created a synthetic version of amylin known as Semlin. And you can see it's pretty effective. I mean, it lowers A1C by about 0.7%, but even more important, I think, is that it lowers body weight by 3 pounds. If you have type 2 diabetes, you have to take it twice a day before meals. And if you have type 1 diabetes, you have to take it with every meal. And so if you have type 1, for example, one more thing that's really important, it's approved only as an adjunct to insulin therapy. So only patients on insulin can be on this medication. So that means I would have to take, if I have type 2, 2 shots of Semlin a day and then up to 4 shots of insulin a day, which is 6 injections. And if I have type 1, that would mean 3 injections of Semlin plus 4 injections of insulin, 7 injections a day. So you can see it's a lot of extra work for our patients, and it does cause a lot of nausea. So because of the work and the nausea, this drug really never took off. And there's also a black box warning for hypoglycemia 3 hours after you inject. The thing about this medication, though, I want to say, I've heard rumors of this for a few years. They're working on combining this medication in the same bottle as insulin. So it would have insulin plus Semlin, and then if you could inject those two together, that would be terrific because you would get benefits of the insulin, the blood sugar lowering, plus the satiation part of the Semlin. So hopefully we'll see that released in the future, and that would be a real benefit for our patients. Okay, I do have one more medication to wrap up. I forgot that we had this little guy left, the dopamine agonist circadian resetter. And this drug is known as Cyclocet. And this medication does increase the morning levels of dopamine. When you increase the levels of dopamine, it's said to reset your circadian cycle and increase your dopamine. When you increase your dopamine, it lowers your blood sugar and also seems to have some cardiovascular protective effect. So this medication, you start at a low dose and you work up to 4.8 milligrams per day. Each tablet is only 0.8 milligrams, so you'd have to take a total of 6 tabs a day to get the full dose. You need to give it within a few hours of waking, and you can see it does reduce the A1C up to 9 percentage points. It does reduce death from cardiovascular events. But this medication, again, is not well utilized. I've never had a patient come in on it. And maybe it's because of the side effects of nausea, vomiting, headaches, and fatigue. It can cause some dizziness. But also, I think the company who purchased it didn't do a lot of marketing for this medication. And so we don't really see this medication used that much. But it is out there, and it is available, and I wanted to let you know about it in case a patient walks in and is on that medication. So some critical points to wrap up is that you want to individualize the glycemic targets and your blood glucose lowering approaches. And really, this is all based on the patient, what they're able to do, their finances, their life expectancy, their other comorbidities, and their ability to participate in diabetes self-care. Diet, exercise, and education are the foundation of type 2 diabetes therapy. So we're always going to keep coming back to that and then looking at medications in addition. Metformin is our go-to med, optimal first-line drug, safe, lots of years of experience with it, and really effective at not only lowering blood sugars but helping with weight management and maybe also protecting, and also helping increase GLP release, which is really important. Combo therapy is reasonable if metformin is no longer helping get blood sugars to target, so we can start adding other medications but keep the metformin on board. Ultimately, about 30% of patients with type 2 diabetes do require insulin therapy, so just their pancreas can't make enough juice, but we'll start with the oral medications and keep adding. Once we get to 3 or more oral medications, we might consider insulin or GLP-1 agonist, keeping the metformin on board. All treatment decisions should be made in conjunction with the patient. Focus on their needs, preferences, and value. And of course, cardiovascular risk reduction is a major focus of therapy since people with diabetes type 2, we really consider them to have cardiovascular disease, so you want to help mitigate those risk factors if at all possible, in addition to lowering the blood sugars. I've listed here some self-study case studies that you can take a look at on your own and kind of go through these and get your pocket cards out and, you know, think about, look at your handout and see, what would I do for these particular patients? How would I make changes, and who would I refer them to help get their blood sugars to target? I've also put in your handout, this is from the AACE, profiles of other of the anti-diabetic medications that are available. And this is another way to look at these medications published by the ACE, and I've put the entire article in your resource center so you can take a look at those. I want to thank you so much for joining this first part of a two-part series in medications. This first part, we were looking at what do the medications do, what are their side effects, the dosing, and we did some case studies. And part two will look more at medication management and apply this information in a way to how to adjust medications and make changes to help get patients to goal. If you have any questions, please feel free to email me or visit our website, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'll be going offline and answering any questions that you may have. But for now, I'm going to wrap up this webcast and say thank you very much, everyone, for joining us.